Welcome, everybody. This is the first office hour session for Econ 3, which is the third installment of our tour of Rothbard's Man Economy and State. And as so often happens here, we only have a few people logged in right now live for the office hour session in the beginning. So I'll let you guys go ahead and post your questions while you're thinking of things. And of course, just type it right into the chat box since there's so few people right now. Let me just explain what happened with for those taking the class for credit. I apologize. The quiz normally on a typical week will go up first thing Friday morning, whereas this week I didn't get it up until the afternoon. What happened is there was a technical snag. My status in terms of the Moodle software, like I was just a student, and so I didn't have the rights to post a quiz, and I happened to be traveling. And so by the time we got that squared away, I was in an airport and couldn't really get online and post the quiz. So anyway, that's why the quiz this particular week didn't go up until Friday afternoon, but going forward, we've got that squared away now. Your quizzes will open up early Friday morning, and then you have until all the way through the following Thursday. So any questions you guys got? For those people who are just trickling in here, go ahead and fire away. Type your questions into the chat box directly, and that's fine. And also, you don't need to wait for me to wrap up my answer to a previous question. Just go ahead. If you have something you want me to talk about, just type it in. And then I'll just calibrate the length of my answers accordingly. Okay, well, you guys are thinking, let me mention something else. A couple of you guys have been asking me over the last several months, when am I going to offer a class again on the business cycle and or on Mises' theory of money and credit. Originally, the plan had been to do it before the end of this calendar year, but we're actually thinking about pushing it back until like January of 2012 is when we'll start that up. And I'm thinking of doing like the greatest hits from theory of money and credit, because one of those topics obviously will be Austrian business cycle theory, since that's where Mises developed it. So just to repeat all that, what I plan on doing is just devoting myself to this class right now, this Man Economy and State Section 3. And then in January, we'll start up with going through Mises' theory of money and credit with an emphasis on his theory of the business cycle. So there's a couple of reasons for that, but it was largely because we're covering money right now in Rothbard's book too, and so there was a concern that there was a lot of overlap. And also, some people have been telling me that they're kind of strapped for money and that, you know, they love taking these online classes, but they need a break to recharge their bank accounts. So for those reasons. And also, it's kind of tough for me to be teaching two classes simultaneously, so I think by pushing that one off, I can focus on this one and, you know, really answer your guys' questions in a timely manner and stay on the ball and devote myself to this one so that I'm not spread too thin for you guys. Okay, so Jeff Leskovar asks, why are interest rates so low when so much debt is being issued? In other words, where is this extra demand for bonds coming from that apparently didn't exist several years ago when rates were much higher? Yes, that's a great question, and this is something that is certainly being used rhetorically by people like Paul Krugman to make it look like Austrian and standard Chicago school type guys who are critical of government deficits. Krugman is using this to make it look like he knows what's going on and we're idiots. So it's a good question, and we should understand, you know, what the facts are, and then also ask ourselves, is this consistent with our worldview, or do we need to rethink how we look at things? So Jeff is right. What what is surprising, perhaps, is the government has been running up massive debts, the federal government, in terms of like the debt to GDP ratio. It's basically doubled in the last couple of years, and it's on track to reach 100%. I'd have to look at the exact numbers, but within, I think, 3 years or so. And, you know, that's kind of a psychological tipping point to say that the federal government owes just, you know, not even talking about Social Security and Medicare and those kind of off-budget things, but saying just how many bonds are people around the world holding to say that the federal government owes more than the entire annual GDP of the country. And that's kind of impressive. So you would think normally that, well, gee, if the government's running up deficits that are more than $1 trillion a year, that are 10% of the size of the economy and so forth, like they've been doing, and they don't even have any plan to really get that under control anytime soon, because even just, you know, so you guys know, like the plan that they adopted when they agreed to raise the debt ceiling, that was like a drop in the bucket. If you look at a chart of how much federal spending was supposed to be, and then in light of these massive budget cuts that those stalwart Republicans dug their heels in and insisted on, I mean, it's nothing. So, I mean, no matter which projection you're looking at, the federal government is going to spend a ton of money and borrow a ton of money over the next decade. So Jeff's question is, why are interest rates yields on government debt so low? Because normally you would think, and the other thing too is, S&P downgraded the government's debt rating. I mean, it used to, U.S. federal debt used to be the definition of a riskless asset. So if you took classes in mathematical finance, for example, some of the things you use in that approach, they need to have what's called the risk-free interest rate, you know, in terms of the theory, to then contrast what investors do when they take on risky assets like stocks. And so when you apply that theory in practice, what people would do is they'd plug in the interest rate for U.S. government debt and say, well, that's what we mean by a riskless asset in the real world, even though we know theoretically the U.S. federal government could default on its bond payments. In practice, we're going to say that's basically an impossible event because Uncle Sam is so creditworthy. And yet, they got downgraded recently. So the point is that why are interest rates so low? This is crazy. And so the Keynesians will say, people like Paul Krugman will say, well, it's because we're in a liquidity trap. And we told you guys this, that back, you know, 2008, 2009, when the federal government was running up these huge deficits and Obama came in and, you know, had his stimulus package, and all you Republicans and conservatives and Austrians were freaking out saying that was going to push up interest rates. You guys are a bunch of idiots. No, it didn't. And, you know, the Keynesians, depending on which ones you read, they have slightly nuanced different explanations for what happened. I think, you know, what Krugman says is that if you draw the supply and demand curves for the loanable funds market, it's actually is intersecting in a negative region. And that, so that even though you're pushing the demand for loanable funds to the right, which normally would push up interest rates, yes, that's technically happening, but it's really just, you know, reducing what the interest rate wants to be from, say, negative 5% to negative 3%. And so since interest rates can only go down to 0%, that's why we're not seeing any real noticeable impact in the interest rate, at least the short-term rates. All right, so that's the kind of argument that Krugman uses. He's basically saying, you know, the economy is so depressed right now that interest rates want to be negative, but they can't because no one's going to – you would just hold cash. You wouldn't lend out $1,000 and say, okay, but I want $950 back next year. Instead of doing that, you would just sit on your $1,000. So nominal interest rates can't go below zero. And so Krugman's saying that's what's going on here, that they're stuck at the zero bound. So even though technically other things equal, it's true, if the government runs a bigger deficit, that should push up interest rates. If you're stuck at that lower bound, you might not observe an increase in interest rates. more generally, what I think is happening, which is sort of consistent with what Krugman was saying, but there's fear, right? So yes, it is true that other things equal, as the federal government runs bigger deficits, it becomes more and more likely that they're going to default at some point in the future. And so as an investor, you would want a higher yield to compensate for that risk of default. At the same time, other things aren't equal. That right now the world's falling apart. You know, there's an entirely plausible scenario in which the euro itself collapses, and so investors don't know what to do with their money, and so they're piling into U.S. Treasuries because that's still perceived as relatively the safest thing around. So I personally think that there's a bubble in sovereign debt, and in particular in U.S. Treasury debt. So for me, this is because, you know, to say that the yield on a bond is low is the same thing as saying its price is really high, because that, you know, that's how bonds work. That if the price, because a bond is a thing giving you a claim that the person issuing the bond is going to give you a fixed amount of money at some point in the future. So right now, its current spot price, the higher it gets bid up, that means the lower the implicit yield on the bond, because you're getting that fixed dollar payment down the road. So how much you have to pay in dollars right now to get that promise, that IOU, you know, you can calculate and say what's the implicit implied rate of return on that investment. So I think U.S. government bonds right now are in a bubble. So just like we had the dot-com bubble in the late 90s, that blew up. Greenspan pushed down interest rates, flooded the market with money, then that fueled a housing bubble. That blew up. Bernanke pushes down interest rates, flood the market with crazy amounts of money. Now what happened? I think we have a bond right now in government debt, which is starting to blow up for European countries, European governments, but I think it's also in U.S. Treasuries. And just like in 2005, 2006, we can now in retrospect look back at housing prices and say, what in the heck were people thinking? How come people couldn't look at the fundamentals and see that housing was so overvalued that it was, of course, it was going to crash? I still think that that's what's going to happen with us, and that, you know, I don't know when it's going to break, but at some point, I think people are going to look back at this period and say, I cannot believe investors were lending money to Uncle Sam for 10 years at 2% or whatever the yield is on a 10-year bond right now issued by the government. So that's, I mean, because it. The other thing, too, is it's not just outright default that's the issue. It's also the problem of price inflation, that if what happens is maybe Uncle Sam makes those dollar payments on schedule without missing a beat, but if that's because prices have gone up 30% over the next 5 years, then that's, you know, you as an investor aren't really getting back dollars of the purchasing power that you kind of had in mind. So that's another thing too, where it's, given all the stuff the Fed is doing, it stuns me as to how low long-term yields are. I can't believe that investors apparently believe we're going to have 2% annual price inflation on average over the next 10 years. But looking at certain market indicators, that's what it looks like investors believe. And to me, that's crazy. So there's a couple different things. So one thing is you could say, well, gee, who's buying all these bonds? Well, the Federal Reserve is, and so are a lot of other central banks. So I think that's part of it when you try to understand how could this bubble be in motion, you know, and how could investors believe that yields are going to remain low for a while? Because that's the thing. If you're an investor and you think that interest rates are going to go up next year, well, then you don't want to lend money right now at a low rate. So another way of saying that is if you bought bonds right now at a very high price, meaning the yield's low, and then next year interest rates across the board go up 2 percentage points, you're going to take a hit. The market value of your bonds will go down. So, you know, the bonds that had already been issued that you already had in your possession. When interest rates go up, the market value of existing bonds goes down. So that's what it would mean for the bubble in bonds to burst. So one way of saying why is this bubble persisting is to say investors think interest rates are going to stay low. So if you believe the Fed when they say, no, we're just going to keep soaking up government debt, we promise you interest rates, short-term interest rates, are going to stay at this exceptionally low level through 2012 and into 2013, which is what the Fed has been saying, well, then that kind of sets the expectations up, and people say, all right, well, I as an investor, I'm okay lending money to Uncle Sam at whatever it is, 50 basis points for a year, because I'm pretty sure the Fed is going to keep a lid on interest rates at least for the next year. And how do I know that? Well, because if interest rates started to rise, the Fed could just come in and print money and buy short-term bonds. So if you think it through, I mean, the Fed's not magical. The Fed cannot – if everybody thought for sure the dollar was going to crash, then they would want to get rid of bonds unless they had a really high interest rate, dollar-denominated bonds, right? So if everyone thought next year prices of things quoted in dollars are going to be 50% higher, nobody right now is going to lend money to somebody at a 2% interest rate if the transaction's in dollars. So you could say, well, so if market interest rates started going up, how would the Fed counteract that? They could just start buying all the bonds themselves. So implicitly, the Fed would be lending money to people at 2% or whatever target rate they wanted to keep. And you'd say, but wouldn't that just add fuel to the fire? If people are worried about prices going up and the Fed just starts printing more dollars, you know, isn't that just a vicious circle? And yeah, it is. But you know, if you think through logically what could happen, I mean, if the Fed was saying, no, we promise we will do it, ultimately what could happen is the Fed could take all existing bonds onto its balance sheet. I mean, that's the logical outcome. If the Fed is determined to keep interest rates low, and no one in the private sector thinks that's a good idea, then the Fed would be the ultimate lender, and everyone issuing bonds would just sell them to the Fed. And the Fed would ultimately accumulate such a large balance sheet, and all the government debt around the world would flow back and be held on the Fed's balance sheet. And so you could have a situation like that, and that would be the logical outcome. So. But we're nowhere near that step right now. Right now, the Fed is a large holder of U.S. government debt, but it doesn't even own half of it. And I forget what the number is off the top of my head. So the Fed is probably the single biggest institutional holder of U.S. government debt, but it's not that it holds even a majority of it. So, that's partly explained, I think, how we got into this equilibrium situation where it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If people think interest rates are going to stay low, then they're willing to buy bonds with low yields. Just like with housing, when there's a bubble going, it can feed itself for a while, right? You can say, why in the world did you pay $200,000 for that house when you know just last year it was only worth $150,000? What are you, crazy? And the person can say, because I think I can flip it and sell it for $250,000 next year. And if the person's right, well, then he was right. And then, the bubble can keep growing. So it's a similar kind of thing here where if everyone or at least a large number of people think the Fed can keep control of the situation for another year, the Fed will be able to keep control of it for another year. But if I'm right and it really is a bubble, the problem is, once it bursts, it falls apart really quickly. The Fed can lose control very quickly. And that's what I've been warning people about, that the Fed has painted itself into a corner, pumping in all that money, the trillion plus in excess reserves that the banks are sitting on. If prices really did start going up at 6, 7, 8% persistently, and the public, everyone realized that, then they're not going to be lending money out for 2%. They're going to be insisting on getting 10%. And then once you had some people willing to pay 10% to borrow money, the banks aren't going to let their reserves sit at the Fed earning 25 basis points. They're going to start lending it out to earn 10%, but then that's just going to fuel it because now more money's flowing out, and the Fed is going to have to decide at that point, are we just going to run the printing press and buy up every last bond out there, or are we going to let this fall apart and let the financial system crash? So that's the sort of nightmare dilemma that I think they're moving towards, where they're going to have to decide, are we crashing the banks or are we crashing the dollar? And they're going to have to choose. Okay, so with that happy thought, let me move on. Lewis says, what would you say are the chief differences between the Misesian and the Rothbardian approach on monopoly and competition? Could we to some extent say Rothbard goes further into a libertarian approach than Mises actually did? I mean, Rothbard seems more closely based on natural rights than merely a utilitarian viewpoint. There's
two things going on in your question there. So on the one hand, just as a, and again, for, I see people have been trickling in here.
If you have a question for me to answer, please just type it right into the chat box. Don't wait for me to finish the answer, because my answer's length will depend on how many questions I think are pending. So just go ahead and type your question in. So there's two things there, Lewis. I think we need to be careful and not conflate Austrian economics with libertarian political theory. So Walter Block makes this distinction a lot, which is funny because you might think if anybody is going to mix the two up, it would be Walter Block, but actually I think that's partly why he's so careful about it, is because he wants to make sure we don't mix the two up, that you can talk about your value-free Austrian economic analysis, which just says objectively, you know, humans act, they have subjective preferences that they implement, and then we as the economists trace out the implications logically of that fact. And we might personally, you know, so you could be an Austrian economist and an advocate of minimum wage laws. You could be an Austrian economist and be a socialist. But what it would mean is that you have an odd value system. Like if you say, I really hate poor people and I don't want them to be able to get a job, and I'm an Austrian economist, so I know if we have minimum wage laws, then I'll achieve my objective and we'll keep poor people from getting a job. So that's why I advocate the government implementing a minimum wage law, because of my knowledge of Austrian economics. Or if I hate people, or if I just really love pristine natural beauty and I think that humans are like a cancer or a parasite on Mother Earth, and I understand how society works in terms of economics and the effect of property rights because I study Austrian economics, I could consistently be a socialist. And I could advocate for one world socialist government because I predict that would lead to mass starvation, and that, you know, millions, perhaps billions of people would die, and that's what I ultimately want, because I think there are too many people right now on Earth. Okay, so you can, you know, those are sort of odd things, and probably in practice we wouldn't expect to see many people holding both of those viewpoints, but Walter Block stresses that to say, you know, you could be an Austrian economist, you could understand Austrian economics, you could be a master of the works of Mises and Rothbard and so forth, and yet not be a libertarian in the political sense. And of course, it would go the other way too. You could be a libertarian and a Keynesian economist. You know, you might have studied economics and think that, I really think that aggregate demand is the way to go, and I think markets are inherently unstable, and that it would, you know, the best way right now, the quickest way to get out of this slump would be if the government would run a huge deficit, and if Bernanke would promise to have more inflation down the road. I think that would reduce real interest rates and we'd get growth and job creation. But I'm a libertarian, so I oppose that. That I believe in natural rights, and I think that would be violating property rights if the government and the Fed did that. So even though it would lead to good, desirable economic consequences, I can't in good conscience condone those policies because it would be violating people's property rights. And so even though I'm a Keynesian economist,
as a libertarian, I have to say the government shouldn't do that stuff. You know, the government should either go back to being a night watchman state or disappear completely if I'm an anarchist libertarian. All right, so the point in me staying on state is just to stress the distinction there. Now, in practice, of course, usually there's an overlap. Usually the Austrian economists also are libertarians, and usually people who are libertarians are at least sympathetic to Austrian economics. And it's not surprising that that's the case, because most people's value systems have them recommend things that they believe would lead to prosperity and lead to, you know, people getting jobs and stuff like that. So it's not surprising that the two overlap, but technically they are distinct things. So when it comes to monopoly theory, again, you just need to be careful. And it's Rothbard himself treads a fine line there in Man, Economy, and State. So I don't mean to be, don't misunderstand, Lewis. I'm not saying that you misread Rothbard or something. I actually had the same thought when I was going through his book there, because he is saying things like, and this isn't going to be an exact quote, but when he's talking about like inelasticities and things, and saying, oh, you know, these guys worry about the monopolist restricting output if the demand curve is inelastic. But what's the big deal? The reason the demand curve is inelastic is because consumers are choosing to spend their money in a certain way. So, you know, they have the right to do that. So whose rights are being violated? And so there, again, I'd have to go look at the exact quote, but, you know, that kind of an approach brushes up on, you know, flirts with mixing up this distinction that I just made. That, you know, you could, it's logically coherent for you to say there is a suboptimal outcome in terms of human welfare or something, some criterion, even though property rights aren't being violated. Like you could just say objectively, yeah, even though nobody's stealing from anybody and everyone's obeying property rights, in certain circumstances, the market economy really doesn't do a good job of channeling resources to what the consumers want. And, you know, so that wouldn't be a contradiction, whereas Rothbard sometimes seems to – Rothbard brings up both elements. I'll put it that way. I'm not saying he's mixing them up, but he's making several points that, you know, he's simultaneously trying to show the market economy – does channel resources efficiently, whether, you know, regardless of how many producers are in an industry, whether they're monopolist or monopolistic competition or huge numbers of entrants that don't have control of much of the market. Rothbard tries to show just objectively, scientifically, there's no reason to suppose the market as an allocative mechanism is inferior in some of these cases versus others. But then he also does bring up political philosophy and notions of what do people have the right to do, what's their just property, and trying to show under alleged cases of monopoly, what's the big deal. So that's true. Now, having said that, let me just say one other thing in defense of Rothbard. Sometimes what he's doing, it's not so much that he's making a standalone argument. So it's not so much that he's just saying people criticize monopolies, but hey, that's everyone's, you know, as long as there was no force or fraud involved, what's the big deal? QED, and then he moves on. No, a lot of times what Rothbard is doing is he'll show that what the allegedly bad thing the monopolist is doing is no different in principle from other situations. So, you know, when he says, how is a monopoly, how are firms coming together and colluding in a cartel, how is that different from two firms merging? And then how is that different from a bunch of people with property coming together and forming a corporation in the first place? That it's just all different people with their own property merging their assets and unifying their decisions in a single financial entity. So how is that, you know, so there, it's not so much that he's trying to prove that cartels are fine with that argument. He's just saying the people who criticize cartels typically don't have a problem with the formation of a corporation. And so Rothbard just saying they're being hypocrites or they're being inconsistent. So that's, you know, rhetorically some of what Rothbard is doing there. As far as you say, you know, what's the difference between Mises and Rothbard? I think the huge difference, and I'm going to talk about this next week, and so in lecture two for this course, we're going to finish the material from chapter 10, and I purposely postponed discussion because I wanted to do it justice. So I'm saving this stuff, the full treatment for next week's lecture. But what I think probably the chief difference is Mises is contrasting the monopolistic outcome with the alleged competitive outcome. And I think Rothbard's big contribution is to just say, what are you talking about? There is no competitive outcome that you can point to as a foil for what the bad monopolist does. So, like Mises, his very demonstration, Mises says, okay, the theoretical problem of monopoly occurs when, first of all, you have a monopolist, so you know, that's a prerequisite. But then Mises adds a further condition, and he says it has to be the case that the demand curve at the level of output that would occur under competitive conditions is inelastic. So then when the monopolist is on the scene, he finds it advantageous to restrict output. So one of the things Rothbard points out there is, how do we know what the competitive level of output is to go check and see what the demand curve is and its elasticity at that point? In the real world, all we have to look at is there's a producer out there and there's a market. And you know, there's a demand curve for some product or service. There's somebody supplying it. And we can see, go see what the actual output is and what the price is. And so how do we look at that outcome and say, oh, well, if only this market were competitive, we think the output would have been higher, and then would the demand curve there have been inelastic or not? I mean, that we're just making stuff up. How could we possibly know that? So I'm going to elaborate on it a little bit, but it's I think it's consistent with what Rothbard is saying. I think what the mainstream economists, and here Mises is just elaborating on their approach, I think what they do, their mistake is they're assuming there was originally a competitive industry with 1,000 different firms, and then they all merged together into one firm and then restricted output. So that, like, chronologically, you originally did have competition in the mainstream sense of the term, and then it turned into monopoly, and then we look at the before and after and say, oh, man, that's thing. But in the real world, the only way that's going to happen is if there were some sort of reason for the monopolist to gain that position. So for one thing, if a person just invents a new good or service out of nothing, there was no competitive output level beforehand. So even on their own terms then, like if I'm trying to think of a good example. Steve Jobs it comes up with the iPhone, you know, smartphone thing, and it's totally new, and no other competitor has anything like it initially. And then they go ahead and look at how much he's charging for it and how much he's producing. There's a sense, if you go ahead and draw those mainstream cost curves and all that stuff, you could concede for the sake of argument that, yeah, if there were 1,000 other Apples, corporate meaning the corporations, with 1,000 other CEOs like Steve Jobs, who all had the same idea and they were all producing smartphones in competition with the iPhone when it first came out, then output would be higher and prices would be lower and consumers would be better off. That may be true, but so what? That's not the world we live in. We don't have 999 other Steve Jobs. We just had him, and he came up with this idea. So the chronological sequence is not that, oh, man, there's this beautifully competitive market where there were tons of smartphones floating around at a low price, and then Jobs came in, merged with all his rivals, and then restricted output and jacked up the price, and now people have to pay more for this iPhone. No, the relevant chronology was before there were no smartphones, and then he came in and is giving them So he didn't restrict output. He created the output. It went from zero to whatever level the monopolist is producing when he innovates and creates a new product that didn't exist before. And far from raising the price before was infinity. No matter how much you paid back in 1980, you couldn't get a smartphone. They didn't exist. So clearly the price came down. The first person to bring a smartphone to market pushed prices down and expanded output. And it's kind of weird to say, yeah, but hypothetically, if we had thousands of other firms that had all that same information and could produce at the same cost structure, then consumers would be better off and the world would be more, you know, would be wealthier. Well, yeah, that's true. Just like if there were 1,000 other Michael Jordans when he was in the NBA, then the people watching basketball would have been better off, but they weren't. Michael Jordan was fairly unique at that point. So, I mean, it's, you know, in a certain sense, these demonstrations that mainstream economists deploy and that actually Mises was adopting in his monopoly analysis, they're kind of silly. They're, on their own terms, they're basically just saying if we had more brilliant people going around and if we could lower these cost structures, then we'd all be better off. Well, okay, that's true, but that's not a critique of the market. That's a critique of reality. Okay, Gilberto says, what would happen to the bond market and the economy in general if we go along with Ron Paul's idea of writing off government debt to the Fed? Ah, boy. I have written on that. It's hard to say because you don't know how people would react to it. And that's really the tricky thing with all this stuff in terms of making predictions and saying, oh, well, what would happen if the euro, you know, what happens if the Greek government defaults on its bonds? What does that mean? It's hard to say because it has to get filtered through the reaction of all the people around the world, and they obviously have different views than I do because I can't believe how low yields are in U.S. government debt. So either I'm wrong or they're wrong. Normally, if the whole market's doing one thing and you're a lone person saying something else, you think, okay, I'm probably wrong because these smart investors can't all be wrong, but we saw in the housing bubble they were wrong. So it, you know, who knows? So in case people don't know what Gilberto was talking about, the idea is, or the proposal Ron Paul had is to say that right now, a lot of, I don't know the number off the top of my head, it's more than a trillion. The Federal Reserve holds a lot of the debt, the outstanding bonds issued by Uncle Sam. So when we were hitting up against the debt ceiling, Ron Paul was saying, well, one way you can get around that is just write off the debt. Just the debt right now that the Fed holds, that technically the Treasury is making interest payments on to the Fed. Just say, no, those bonds are null and void. We don't owe you that money anymore. So one immediate effect of that would be the Fed would be insolvent because the Fed's sitting on a bunch of assets, a lot of which are government bonds, and then it has liabilities. And just like a regular company, the Fed accountants can say, oh, our equity or our capital is assets minus liabilities. So if all of a sudden a trillion plus or whatever the number is of the Fed's assets go to zero because the Fed just, or the Treasury says, we're not paying those anymore, then the Fed would be bankrupt in an accounting sense. So that would probably freak people out. It would warm the hearts of Austrian libertarians, but regular investors would probably freak out if all of a sudden the Fed were insolvent from an accounting viewpoint. So what would that, I mean, I don't know what effect that would have. I think probably for sure what would happen is interest rates on treasuries would go up because people would say, whoa, if the Treasury defaults on the Fed, maybe they're going to start defaulting on other stuff too, like all the bonds that are theoretically held by the Social Security Administration. maybe the Treasury would just say, well, that's debt that we owe to ourselves, we're just going to cancel that. And maybe they might say bonds held by others, you know. So I think investors would think that was like a precedent, that once the Treasury just wrote off those hundreds of billions in liabilities, maybe they would come up with reasons to start writing off other stuff too. And so I think probably people, you know, the bond rating of the U.S. government would get knocked down a lot at that point. And so I think investors would require a much higher yield, because now they would be thinking there's a good chance the Treasury would default on their payments. So that would make interest rates go way up, I think. I'm trying to think. But it all depends on how it's framed. I mean, if Ron Paul became president and did it, and he said, you know, here's my plan, I'm going to, you know, freeze this kind of spending, I'm going to cut the military budget in half over the next 2 years, you know, bring all the troops home, I'm going to end the drug war, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to start, get rid of the income tax, we're going to start privatizing federal assets, and, you know, here we're going to, so over the next 5 years, we're going to, over the next 3 years, we're going to balance the budget, and then after that, we're going to start running huge surpluses and paying off the debt. And one thing we're going to do right now, I've been saying this for a long time, is the Federal Reserve, we need to shut it down, and we're going to repudiate the debt that we owe to the Fed, but we're going to continue to make our interest payments and everything else. And in fact, you can be sure we're going to do that, because look at all these spending cuts I'm going to push through. And then once people saw that he was serious about it, and he really did start bringing troops home and started, you know, reducing the size of the military and had, you know, cutting dozens of billions of dollars in one fell swoop from the military budget, stuff like that, and bringing in hundreds of billions by selling off federal land, selling off the rights to offshore drilling and things. I mean, if people said, oh, this guy is serious, then the interest rates could even go down. You know, maybe the bond rating would go back up to AAA. So it depends what the expectations were. I'm just thinking, if Ron Paul did do that, the mainstream media would just go into overdrive. They'd be quoting everybody from Paul Krugman down to the janitor at the local elementary school saying what a nut job he was. You can't default on the bonds to the Fed. What are you, crazy? This will blow up the world. So I think probably in practice interest rates would go up at least for a year or two until people saw that he was serious and really was actually making the government more fiscally sustainable. But again, that's the thing with this stuff, is it depends on how people are interpreting the events beyond just the fundamentals of the event itself. A good thing, Gilberto, is that, and I think this is partly why Ron Paul proposed it, is that it might seriously crimp the Fed's ability to continue normal operations. Because that's how the Fed works, is it buys government bonds and creates money in so doing. And so if the Treasury just defaulted on all the bonds held by the Fed officials might think twice before they bought government bonds again, because they'd be worried, well, gee, if we just dig ourselves into a big hole again and then they default, we're going to blow up again. So I think that's partly the strategy involved, that not only would it, you know, I think what Ron Paul was trying to do was we had this crisis of the debt ceiling, and I think he was trying to show, here's one solution that people might go for because they were so angry at the Fed and the bankers and everything. And they needed, you know, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? The government's up against this limit, and it's going to be really painful if we have to cut spending. So I think he was trying to show, well, one way you could get around this, you know, get over this hump, is to stick it to the Fed. And so I think that was part of his strategy, is if they did follow that advice, then the Fed would have been seriously injured by that, not only from the one shot taking away a trillion plus of their assets, but also how could they continue to operate as a central bank if they were worried that every time there's a budget crisis, the Treasury might just default in the bonds that we hold. So I think that was part of the strategy. And also, too, just as an educational thing, I think he was doing that because he wanted the public conversation to focus on, yeah, why does the Treasury send so much interest to the Fed? I mean, because it's a weird situation where the Fed creates money out of thin air, buys bonds with it, and then earns interest income off of those bonds, a large portion of which are funded out of tax dollars. So it's, you know, when people hear that and they realize, are you kidding me? So we got a bunch of private bankers who own this institution that creates money out of thin air, lends it to the government, and then we all have to pay taxes to pay interest to these private bankers ultimately for money they created out of thin air and lent to us. Like, that shocks people when they realize that's the system that we're operating in. And I think partly Ron Paul was, you know, he didn't actually think they were going to take his advice, but he just wanted to put that out there so people would talk about it, and more people just hearing the conversation would say, wait a minute, how does our system work? And be outraged. Okay, any other questions from you guys? Jeff Leskovar says, is the Fed growing its balance sheet now? Well, let's see. Let me switch to, unfortunately, I don't think you can look at the balance sheet per se from the Fred website, which is my favorite go-to place for data. So let me just see what happens if you Google Fed balance sheet. It's the H41 release. So what is this? Hang on, that's kind of hard to see. Well, yeah, as of April, it was still growing. Here, I'll send you the link I'm looking at right here. So there's a picture of it, if you click that link. It's one interesting thing. This isn't directly answering your question, Jeff. My sense, Jeff, is that it's probably tapered off until they make like another big push. What they've been doing is, as stuff matures, they just roll it over. And that was one of the announcements they made in the Operation Twist. You know, everyone was focusing on the twist part of it, that they were buying longer-term bonds and selling shorter-term ones. But another thing that the Fed just said matter-of-factly in that press release was that they were going to start rolling over mortgage-backed securities and agency debt. And by agency debt, they meant bonds issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So that was actually a change in policy. Before then, the idea was, you know, they were sitting on all these mortgage-backed securities and bonds issued by Fannie and Freddie, but as those things matured, they were either just going to roll them into treasuries or they were just going to let the Fed's balance sheet shrink. I don't know what the plan was, but for sure they weren't pledging to maintain their stock of those assets. And so the idea was they did a few one-shot interventions to prop up the housing market, but now they were done and they were going to let those components of their balance sheet dwindle away gradually over time. And in that Operation Twist announcement, they said, no, we're not doing that. We're maintaining our existing level of intervention. So that doesn't answer your question about the total overall size of the balance sheet, but I think that they're basically holding it constant until they make some new major policy announcement. Okay, Jeff says, everyone says that the banks are holding the excess reserves at the Fed, thus keeping prices in check. But as the Fed buys U.S. government debt, that money is getting spent. So what is holding down prices? Yeah, this is a really subtle point, and I keep flipping myself on it. Not the term about the prices, but the term about, or the point about buying government bonds. So let me give you the way that the problem that the way I've encountered it, and I'm still not sure how to think through it. So for sure, banks are so the Fed buys assets, let's say, and then those reserves. So a check that the Fed writes, a check buys $1 billion worth of government bonds from a securities dealer, writes a check for $1 billion drawn on the Federal Reserve. That securities dealer, he gives the bonds to the Fed, the Fed puts it on its balance sheet on the asset side. The securities dealer has a check from the Fed for $1 billion, so he goes to his bank and deposits it. So now, let's say it's whatever, Bank of America credits that shareholder's or securities dealer's checking account for $1 billion, and now Bank of America runs that check, clears it with the Fed, and the Fed says, oh, okay, Bank of America, now your account with us, whoop, we credit for $1 billion. So now Bank of America has $1 billion more in reserves, and their customer has $1 billion in his checking account. So if Bank of America, and now like 900 million of those would be excess reserves. So if Bank of America chose to lend out 900 million by giving it to businesses who want to take out business loans, and then it credits all their checking accounts for a total of 900 million, then that's the normal textbook way that banks multiply and pyramid on top of an initial injection of reserves from the Fed. That wasn't happening much. It actually has been happening in the last 8 months that lending has resumed, but initially that wasn't happening. The banks were not granting new loans of that type. And so it was correct. People were saying, oh, the banks are just sitting on those excess reserves earning 25 basis points or whatever the number was from the Fed. Instead of lending out the 900 million excess reserves, Bank of America would just let it sit at the Fed earning a small interest rate on it. But what's interesting is what banks also are doing is they are buying treasuries. And that's why people are talking about the fact they're trying to explain how come bank profits are so high. And people, a lot of different analysts have said, oh, because what's going on is they're getting money from the Fed at basically 0%, and then they're turning around and buying treasuries at 2% or 3%, depending on the maturity. And so the banks are earning that spread basically risklessly, unless you think Uncle Sam's going to default. And it's so the Fed has pushed down interest rates, destroying regular people in the private sector because now they can't save, they can't earn anything, destroying pension funds or whatever. But now is a way of subsidizing the banks. So now the banks have this pretty safe spread that they earn by getting money from the Fed at 0% and then lending it to the government at 2% or whatever it is. So you're thinking, I'm thinking through that. Wait a minute, but I thought we said that the banks weren't, they're keeping the reserves parked at the Fed. So how could it be? Which one is it? Are they keeping the reserves parked, or are they using those reserves to go lend to the government? And the thing that's tricky is I think it's both. So here I'm not 100% sure, and like I said, I've flipped a couple times when I'm thinking through it, but I believe So Bank of America's got $900 million in excess reserves. Let's say they go to a bond auction and the federal government issues $900 million in new debt. So Bank of America says, oh, we want that. So they write a check to the Treasury for $900 million and take $900 million in bonds and hold it. And then, as you say, well, the Treasury will expend the money, so it's writing checks around. But ultimately, those, that's not creating new money in terms of M1 and N2. That's just changing who owns those reserves. So when Bank of America writes a $900 million check to the Fed and gives it to it, or to the Treasury deposits that check. Uncle Sam has an account with the Fed. So the Fed just says, okay, we subtract $900 million from Bank of America's checking account, and we add $900 million to Uncle Sam's. And then when Uncle Sam spends that money, you know, it spends $100 million on a defense contractor to give him tanks. So the defense contractor takes the check for $100 million, deposits in his bank. And so the, from the Fed's point of view, it's just moving around where those reserves are. So ultimately, when that money all ends up back in banks, and you say, what are the excess reserves in the system? It's still the same number. Those are still $900 million in excess reserves once they get, they move around. And so I think what happens there is, if a commercial bank wants to lend money not to its clients by giving them a loan and giving them a new checking account, but rather just by buying bonds from the government, that doesn't expand the money supply in the textbook's way that we normally talk about the money multiplier. They're just taking their excess reserve directly and handing it over to the government that spends it, and then they just, you know, ultimately find their way back into banks that are held by different banks as excess reserves. But in terms of the overall system, there's still excess reserves. So I think that's what's going on here, and so that's why it could be simultaneously true to say the banks aren't lending the money out the way we describe in a standard macro 101 or 201 textbook, and the banks are sitting on excess reserves earning interest, and to say the banks are risklessly taking money from the Fed at 0% and lending it to the government at 2% and earning the spread, that those can both be true. And so then your main point, why isn't that pushing up prices? Well, for one thing, prices are going up, even in absolute terms. Prices right now are higher than they've ever been in history. And even the annual rates right now, the standard consumer price index is 3.8% higher than it was last year, which obviously isn't hyperinflation, but it's nothing to sneeze at. And the other thing, too, is prices were collapsing in the fall and winter of 2008, and then they turned around and started zooming back up. So I think it's not just enough to say what was the absolute change in the price level, but to say how much higher are prices now compared to what they would have been following the housing burst if the Fed hadn't pumped in a bunch of new money. And so it's not, you know, so in that sense, we could have had 20% price inflation over the last few years compared to what the baseline would have been. But we, you know, we don't know because we didn't live that alternate universe. So those are a few points. So you're right, Jeff. Well, just be careful. This is we're running out of time here. This is the last point I'll make. I think, Jeff, so you are on the right track, but I'm thinking, looking at your question again, I think maybe you're looking at it. But, well, no, you're looking at it the right way. I mean, if there's a subtlety, because I think you're saying, oh, the Fed buys bonds and then the Treasury spends that, so how is that not pushing up money? You're right, but I mean, strictly speaking, there's a middleman. The Fed doesn't directly buy bonds from the government. So technically there's someone in the private sector who lends money to the government by buying a bond. The government spends that money. If that were the end of the story, that wouldn't be price inflationary because the private lender would have less money and the government would have more, and it would all balance. But then the private lender gets made whole by selling the bonds to the Fed that then creates the money out of thin air to give to them. So you're right, that initial burst, that's where the new money comes from. But that, how can I put it? I guess the problem is, and I'd have to think through this to say it exactly, but part of what's going on when people say, oh, the banks are sitting on the money, they mean there isn't the further multiplication, the further pyramiding of new money creation on top of the one-shot burst of what the Fed did. Because that's the thing. Normally, in a textbook way, we teach this stuff before this crisis occurred. We'd say, oh, if the Fed buys $1 billion worth of new assets, that injects $1 billion of new money in the economy, but then commercial banks lend $9 billion on top of that. So actually there's a $10 billion increase. And so what we're saying when we say the banks are sitting on the reserves is we're saying that $9 billion further increase hasn't been happening. So, but you're right, the $1 billion happened. And like I say, I think part of the way you see that is you can look at what the CPI was doing in the fall of 08. It was falling off a cliff. And then it turned around and started zooming back up. So I think you did see that massive burst of inflation from the Fed turned around prices, and then they've been rising ever since. Okay, well, I'll stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you on Wednesday.